From PRI, Public Radio International, I'm Tavis Smiley. I traveled to Detroit this past week to explore the city's rise, fall, and potential for rebirth. We start by talking with Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan.
Mayor Duggan, good to have you on this program, sir.
Well, welcome to Detroit,
Tavis. Glad to be back. Let me, my time with you is so limited. Let me jump right in. The chocolate city of Detroit has a white mayor. Has too much been made of the fact that you're the first white mayor of this city in 40 years?
If you were to go around this city with me right now in any neighborhood, you see there's no big deal being made of it. You know, I ran for this office by doing 250 house parties. Anybody who invited me to their living room or den or basement, I sat night after night with people in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And when you sit with people in that kind of setting, what divides us tends to fade to the background, and what we have in common comes together, and the election wasn't all that close. The city's been very supportive.
As very modestly put, it wasn't even close. How would you describe, as we sit here right now, the state of the city?
I think there's a sense of optimism, but we have a long way to go. But the police are showing up faster, the ambulances are showing up faster, the street lights are coming on, houses are being taken and moving families in, not just being demolished. I think there's a sense it's going the right way, but it's going to be a long grind to get back to the kind of city we should have.
I've been here so many times over the years, and I couldn't wait to get back on this trip because I wanted to see what had been done, what had become of downtown. I've been reading about this for months now, of course, and it's pretty clear. You can see it as you drive through downtown. The downtown area is coming back. I guess my question is, how do you ensure that what's happening in downtown becomes a bridge to the rest of the city and not just an island unto itself?
Yeah, well, that's why I got elected. Was I ran on a platform of every neighborhood has a future, and I still do at least one meeting a week in somebody's home in a neighborhood with the neighbors, so I stay in touch. But we started out with a very clear plan that said the streetlights in the city don't work. In the last 12 months, we've gotten 40,000 street lights, new LED lights, all in the neighborhoods, on in this city. We filed about 1,500 lawsuits against the owners of abandoned houses and neighborhoods, telling the owners you have two choices. You either sign a court order to get it fixed up and occupied, or deed it to us and we'll sell it on the internet like eBay. And our website, buildingdetroit.org, we're auctioning two houses a day, about to go to three houses a day. We've auctioned 300 houses, so we've got families moving back in. And the thing I'm proudest of is this year we had 25 neighborhoods whose property values increased from the year before. We haven't seen that in a long time, and my goal is next year it'll be 50 neighborhoods whose property values increased. So we're working at it in a very concerted way.
Yeah. If the city is turning around, and I think it is slowly but steadily, who is it turning around for? And I ask that because at every turn of history where there was some sort of revolution, we were told that Black folk were going to get some of the goods. We were told that during the Industrial Revolution. We were told that during the Technological Revolution. I know there's a huge tech boom here in the city of Detroit. So if the city is turning around, who is it turning around for?
Well, hopefully it's going to turn around for the longtime residents in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But we just landed a $150 million investment in a manufacturing research facility for lightweight metals. The next generation of metals that will go into cars and planes are going to be built on Rosa Parks in Detroit, and the people who will be trained to manufacture this new line of metals is being done at Focus Hope, a Detroit-based training program that has been in existence almost 40 years, opportunities for Detroiters. We just announced a 250-employee distribution facility on the east side of Detroit. We've got a hockey arena on a surrounding neighborhood being rebuilt where the Illich family signed an agreement that 51% of all the work done on the projects will be done by residents of the city of Detroit. And we monitor that quarterly, tracking every hour. So we're creating opportunities for Detroiters, but there's also opportunities for people who choose to move into this community and Detroit is, and we're welcoming immigrants in a way that we never have in the city's history. So we're building a Detroit that we think includes everybody.
For that matter, Hispanics, the numbers I see are growing significantly in this city as well.
The Bengali community as well. It's very interesting.
You mentioned the automobile industry. To what extent is the future of this city linked inextricably or otherwise to the auto industry?
You know, it always will be. Mm-hmm. You know, we got a bill passed in Lansing right before Christmas to allow us to bring in up to 10 manufacturing facilities on the east side of Detroit with a tax break, a 12-year no taxes, with the goal being, and I'm talking to Ford and GM and Chrysler, bringing their suppliers from Mexico to the city of Detroit. And I think there's a lot of interest on the part of the auto companies to do it. But we're not asking for a handout. We're showing them that, that with what we have to offer, we think we can be cost competitive here in Detroit. And if we do that, now we start to bring jobs back. So we'll always have a strong tie to the auto industry. On the other hand, if you look at what is happening with Dan Gilbert and the like, you're also seeing tech jobs and white-collar jobs come back at the same time. And if you come up into the Midtown area, lots of entrepreneurs starting businesses. So to bring the city back, it's not going to be one strategy. It's going to take everything working.
You mentioned Dan Gilbert, and I have nothing against Dan Gilbert. One has to respect the fact and appreciate the fact that he has decided, amongst others, to put a stake in the ground here, to do what he can to help turn the city around. On the other hand, that's also how people end up getting unfair advantages. One guy ends up owning and controlling an unfair slice of the pie, so to speak. And I'm not accusing him of having done that. I'm just asking, how do we ensure that Dan Gilbert or any other person, since I don't want to demonize him, don't end up owning the city of Detroit?
Well, he didn't have an unfair advantage. Nobody's given him any break, any assistance, or anything else. He's chosen to take his own money.
Right.
He owned one in Quicken Loans, one of the largest employers in the state of Michigan, spread through four suburban communities, and he made the decision to bring what is now 12,000 employees into the city of Detroit and consolidate him here. And as he's done that, more and more have moved in. So nobody's given him any break. He's earned everything he's gotten. And I think the great majority of Detroiters, you know, I remember in 2006, we had the Super Bowl here. Mm-hmm. I was on the Super Bowl committee, and we had to paint the storefronts of most of the downtown storefronts on Woodward so our visitors wouldn't know that they were vacant. We made them look like they were operating businesses. Today, you go down those streets just 8 years later, and they are all filled with stores and shops, and every one of those creates opportunity. So Dan Gilbert's been a very positive contributor for the city.
Let me close with this. As you move around the city, what's your sense? How would you describe the mood of the city, and what makes you hopeful about the future of the city?
You know, I still drive myself, and if I stop for gas or go into any corner of the city, people will come up, they'll hug me, they'll get a picture taken. They'll tell me how happy they are about the street light or the fact we cleaned up the illegal dump site. Then they'll proceed to tell me about the dead tree or the buses that aren't running on time, which is the way it is. But the interesting thing is they're telling me because they think that, that our administration is going to succeed in doing something about it. So we're not under any illusion about how much work we have to do. But I think there's a feeling in the city that we're headed the right direction.
I'm honored to have you on this program. Your city's mayor, that is, Mayor Mike Duggan. Right. Good to have you on, Mayor. Good to see you. Thank joining you. Me now, Pulitzer Prize winner, Stephen Henderson, the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, host of Detroit Public Television's American Black Journal, and investigative journalist Kurt Guyette, whose reporting on Detroit is supported by a grant from the Ford Foundation to the ACLU of Michigan. The Ford Foundation, by the way, is one of our funders for this week. Glad to have both of you here, Kurt and Stephen. Let me start by saying congratulations to you. I saw as soon as I got in town that you won the Scripps Howard Award. So wait, hold up. So last year, the Pulitzer Prize.
Uh-huh.
This year, the Scripps Howard Award. Stephen Henderson, y'all. Stephen Henderson.
Yeah.
So shout out to you first. Let me start with Kurt. Kurt, you heard my conversation with the mayor. The mayor seems to have a pretty, maybe rosy is an overstatement, because he did say there's a long way to go, so I don't want to mischaracterize what he said and say rosy, but your sense of his optimism about the future of the city.
Well, you have two Detroits, and it's almost a cliche to be saying that now, but it's as true as ever. More true in some ways. Downtown is definitely rebounding and thriving. You go out into the neighborhoods and there's a lot of misery. Mm-hmm. Water shutoffs are, they're getting gearing up to do mass residential shutoffs soon. They say there's not a timeline, but it's definitely in the planning stages.
And they're shutting the water off, why?
Because people can't afford it.
Okay.
Either that or it's abandoned buildings. Abandoned buildings, they should definitely be out shutting it off, because scrappers get in there, they steal the plumbing, and water starts flooding in. So that's a huge problem.
Right.
So going after vacant buildings should definitely be a priority. But they're also shutting it off for people who can't afford it. Last year, I went out and followed off the shut-off crews, and you talk to people, and it's people on disability, people with mental disabilities, people with physical disabilities, people who are, you know, single mothers, And water rates just keep going up and up and up. And it's not just a problem in Detroit. It's a problem throughout the region.
So the city's just come out of bankruptcy. What's the city to do about persons who can't afford to pay their water bill when the city has to pay its bills? What do you do?
Well, there's a proposal. There's been a longstanding proposal to base water rates on income, mm-hmm. so that just because you're poor doesn't mean you shouldn't get water. Mm-hmm. You know that the EPA, I believe, recommends like 2.5% of a person's income should go to water, not more than that. So there, and actually there's been studies that show if you make rates reasonable, people pay. Mm-hmm. So, but it's when they're out of reach that right. they don't get paid, and then they pay contractors to go out and shut it off.
So Stephen, what most worries you or concerns you about the comeback, or have you drank the Kool-Aid?
Well, I mean, I think the bankruptcy was an opportunity. It was a reset, a do-over of sorts. But it was just an opportunity. And now comes all the work that needs to be done. Kurt's right. You go out in the neighborhoods, this is a very different place. There's a lot of despair. There's unbelievable poverty. There is isolation increasingly, like you would see in rural areas as opposed to urban areas. And those are the things we got to start tackling to make Detroit a better place for people who've been here for decades, not just the new people who are coming, who should be welcome, and whose money we need to pay taxes to provide services. But we've got to get into those neighborhoods and not just provide better services, but provide a little more hope for people to move up the economic ladder.
To take Kurt's word, though, how do you make sure, he used the word misery, how do you make sure that misery doesn't have the last word? Put another way, how do you ensure that the folk who've been here a long time aren't left out of the revitalization?
Well, that's if I had a quick answer to that question, I wouldn't just be mayor, I might be governor or president. You know, I think there are a lot of things that work together to make Detroit a tough place. One is the poverty, the lack of income that we see, the lack of training for people to be able to get jobs to have income, the lack of a decent school system to start them off in life the right way, to be able to get training for a job. I mean, it starts very early here with not enough investment, with not enough opportunity. And those are things that just that are not just about city government and what it does. We need the state government to invest a lot more in Detroit, and we need the federal government to help us more.
I asked the mayor about Dan Gilbert, since he raised Dan Gilbert's name in this conversation, who owns Quicken Loans, owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, owns a whole bunch of stuff, and you're worth $60 billion. But are you at all concerned that the city, I want to be careful here, might get colonized in this recovery?
Well, I mean, well, that's a strong word. Is your word, not mine?
Yeah. it was just a question. I'm just asking questions.
So I am very concerned about the extent to which we are relying on one person and one person's money mm-hmm. to do what's happening in downtown. That's not healthy for the city. That's not healthy for his business, I don't think. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of thing that actually will turn things around in the long run, I don't think. You need other investors to come to the table a lot more aggressively than they have, and you need more participation from businesses who've been here for a long time. Those are the two things that we're missing. Dan Gilbert deserves an awful lot of credit mm-hmm. for being the first to say, I'm coming in from the suburbs with a huge change, and I'm going to bring 12,000 people downtown. We need more people to do that. We need more participation from people who are already here.
Kurt, Stephen mentioned education. My time is just about up here. We're going to spend a night here while we're in town talking about education. Your thoughts about what happens to education, specifically Detroit public schools in this city?
Well, one thing that we've seen is that emergency management, Detroit Public Schools has been under state control for the past 6 years, four different emergency managers. It's been a disaster. Nobody at this point would argue that emergency management of Detroit Public Schools has been a success. It's been a disaster. They failed to halt the financial crisis, and they have not improved education. All they created is instability. So about that part, there is no debate.
I'll close this conversation the same way I close with the mayor. I think I may do this for every guest I have because I'm curious to get their take on this one question. What makes you hopeful about the future if you are?
I think we finally have the pieces in place to take advantage of an opportunity like the bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. I think our political leadership, I think the goodwill that we're experiencing, we finally are in a place to say, let's do these things and move forward on a long-term basis, not a short-term.
Kurt, is hope on a tightrope?
It is. The thing that gives me hope is the resilience of the people of Detroit. The people of Detroit are amazing, amazing. And it breaks your heart to see what's happening in the neighborhoods. But the resilience of people is truly, truly amazing.
Let me thank Kurt Guyette and Stephen Henderson for being with us today. Many American cities have faced financial difficulties, but few have ever gone bankrupt, particularly a city as large as Detroit.
The judge who approved the plan, Stephen Rhodes, who delayed his retirement to oversee the city's emergency ideas from Chapter 9, is with us. Judge Rhodes, honored to have you on this program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, sir.
Let me start by asking the obvious question for those of us who have been watching this story unfold around the country. Did the city need to file bankruptcy?
It absolutely did. Uh-huh. It was about to run out of money to pay its bills and to pay its employees, and the only way for it to solve its financial problems was to file bankruptcy.
Should it have filed bankruptcy sooner than it did?
Yes. I held in court that it should have filed perhaps as early as 2005.
Mm-hmm. And it filed actually when?
On July 18th, 2013.
You know the date, huh?
Yes. And the time, 4:06 p.m.
What difference might have been made had the bankruptcy been filed in 2005 and not 2013?
It's very hard to speculate about that. Of course, if that bankruptcy had been as successful as this one was, the city would be that far, that much further ahead in its recovery at this point in time.
How bad was the situation when you say they filed Chapter 9 in 2013? What kind of numbers are we talking about? How bad was the situation?
Well, the city had $18 billion in debt, which it could not pay. It had $3 billion in unfunded pension obligations and over $5 billion in retiree health care benefits that it could not pay. It was about to run out of money, as I mentioned, and it was desperate. Filing bankruptcy was absolutely the right thing to do.
I think some people think that filing bankruptcy means that all of your creditors get the same thing, that they all get something that is equal. That's not exactly what it means. So how does one go about deciding who gets what when you owe billions of dollars?
Well, as a general rule, bankruptcy divides the world of creditors into two kinds. Secured creditors, those are creditors who have what the law calls a security interest in specific property, and the other class is called unsecured creditors. The law does not prohibit discrimination in the treatment of unsecured claims. It only prohibits unfair discrimination. And it's up to the judge in the case to decide whether the different treatment of different kinds of unsecured claims is unfair or not. And that was one of the issues that I was presented with in the case.
So I hear the distinction you're making between being treated fairly as opposed to being treated equally. I hear that distinction. Right. How did you figure out what that means, though, being treated fairly?
Well, there's little more to it than just the judge thinking about what his conscience says. We all are raised with what a sense of fairness is, and that's what we access when we make this distinction. In my case, the pension claims were treated much better, for example, than the general unsecured claims. The pension classes received between 60 and 70% of their claims. The general unsecured creditors received 10%. I found that that was fair because the city's mission is to serve people, and it needs its employees to carry out its mission. And of course, every employee is going to be a retiree, so it has a mission-based justification to treat its employees, who are future retirees, and its retirees better than its general unsecured creditors and its bondholders, for that matter.
And yet, as you know, for your commentary notwithstanding, and you're bending your back to try to make this deal as fair as you could, your supporters believe, for the pension holders. I suspect that's probably still one of the things that sticks in the craw of many of the residents of this city. They feel that this bankruptcy happened on the backs of retirees. that, again, with your effort notwithstanding, that it was not fair to the persons who have spent their lives mm-hmm. in dedication to this city, who saw their pensions cut even at the level that it was cut. How do you respond to those who think that this deal just wasn't fair?
I understand that concern. There is certainly sacrifice that this plan requires of retirees. But whenever there's a bankruptcy, whether it's a Chapter 9 or a Chapter 11, everyone has to sacrifice because mm-hmm. there just isn't the money, there aren't the assets to pay everyone in full. The city did not have the money to pay retirees' claims. And so it was our job to do the best we could, given the resources that the city had, to pay the claims. And I think we did that.
Before we started the show tonight, I was talking to the audience assembled here and saying to them that one of the reasons why I wanted to come here is because for this entire week is because I believe that there are perhaps some policies and practices that are now being implemented in this city that the rest of the country might learn from, in part to avoid in other cities what's happened here in Detroit. I think of Chicago, for example. There's an election there coming up in just days. And that election is in part being waged around what's going to happen mm-hmm. To the employees of the city and to the city writ large, because the debt in that city is so high, and they have a problem, you know, funding their pension plan, as you well mm-hmm. know. I raise all that to ask whether or not you are concerned that given the decision you made here, which is that pensions are not protected in bankruptcy, that other cities now will use Chapter 9 bankruptcy as a way to exit their responsibilities to public pension holders?
I think that is a genuine concern. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also true that many cities around the country will not be able to put together what we did in Detroit, which mm-hmm. was the grand bargain, which resulted in over $800 million from the state and from private sources coming into our pension plans. I think that at least a partial answer to that question is that municipal officials have to start paying much closer attention to their pension obligations. They have to make the pension contributions that the plan requires. They have to be realistic about the investment rates of return, and they have to employ good management techniques to be sure that the pension plans fulfill their obligations. There is another answer here, right, however, which I think many municipalities around the country are beginning to consider, and that is to move from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, just like much of private corporations around the country have done. I think that's something that should be examined in this country.
I've got less than 2 minutes. Let me see if I can squeeze out two or three quick questions. We're going to talk in a moment, since you mentioned the grand bargain. We're going to talk in a moment with the director of the museum here. There are many people who believe that it was the museum, in part, that helped save the city.
Yes.
That art helped save the city. We'll talk about that in a second. For those who don't know what this grand bargain was, in short, what was the grand bargain that was able to be worked out in this city?
The terms of the grand bargain were that a group of foundations came together and contributed $600 million to the city's pension plan. The state contributed nearly $200 million to the pension plans. And in exchange for that, the pension plans gave up their claim that the art should be sold, and the art was put into a public trust mm-hmm. so that it would no longer ever be subject to the claims of creditors. Mm. That was the grand bargain.
Two other quick questions, right quick. One, I was tickled, I guess the best word I can come up with, at some comments I saw you make about how surprised you were that my industry, the media industry, the broadcasting, the news business, didn't press you to put cameras in the courtroom. Here's something that matters to every citizen of this city. And I think you were even surprised, if I read your comments correctly, that the media didn't press you harder here locally to get access to the courtroom.
Well, that's right. Every citizen of the city of Detroit, and indeed of the state of Michigan, had a stake in the outcome mm-hmm. of the bankruptcy. It was really their case. And I felt that the citizens therefore had a right to watch their public officials, their elected officials, and their unelected official, Mr. Orr, testify about what they were doing to revitalize this city. There were several times during the case when they testified, and the public should have had the opportunity to watch them testify.
Yeah. Finally, because the audience at home didn't see this, I've been in court many times, don't ask me why.
Okay.
I've been in court many times, and I have been ordered to stand up when the judge walks into the courtroom. But I have never seen a judge walk into a room where an audience just voluntarily applauded when you walked in. I think that says something, as tough as your job was, but how the audience here and the people of the city appreciate at least your effort in trying to save the city. How do you feel about the role that you've played in history in helping at least to save the city?
Well, I'm proud of my work on the case, but I do have to say that it was a team effort. The mediators played their role, the lawyers played their role, Kevin Orr certainly played his role. It was a team effort, and everyone acted with great civility and competence and professionalism, and I'm very optimistic about the future of the city. The city has adjusted its debt. It has a debt structure that it can now handle. It has a plan to revitalize city services, and it has the leadership that's necessary to execute that plan.
As I said a moment ago, we'll talk about how art helped save the city of Detroit. In a moment, for now, though, we ask you to thank Judge Stephen Rhodes. When the city got into financial trouble, somebody thought it was a good idea to auction off the masterpieces at the art museum as a way to pay off the debt. Thankfully, sanity saved the day. And here to talk about what art did to save the city from DIA, Graham Beal and Sarupa Anila, please welcome them to the program. So Graham, the judge talked about this just a little bit, but this was such a creative and innovative idea that you all came up with. I saw a headline when I got to town that said, in my research, Detroit exits bankruptcy, art saves the day. How did art save the day in the city of Detroit?
Well, it was the only immediate asset that seemed to be owned by the city, if you accept that premise, mm-hmm. which of course some of us never did, mm-hmm. Owned in the sense of a liquefiable asset. And there were all the businesses that had invested, all the creditors and the insurance that were going to be losing money, and then there was the pension fund that had been mismanaged and was going to be inflicting serious hardship. And for a while, there was some people suggested, well, you know, is it the art or is it the pensions? Which should we do? But before we could actually get to the point of that being articulated in any meaningful sense, Chief Federal Judge Jerry Rosen came up with a scheme that turned that actually on its head. And basically, it was a long and difficult process, but basically brought together a coalition of foundations, of the governor and the state and the DIA to create a pot of money of $800 million that would go to the pension fund over 20 years. In exchange for that, the DIA would become what it actually was 95 years ago, before it became a city department, a standalone private 501c3 self-perpetuating charity. And that would mean that the art, which would make it more like most art museums in the country, actually, it would make the art safe. And so then it was a matter of, that was between November and it took a year to sort through all that, but it finally came off.
So I read somewhere that the entire art collection is worth well over $1 billion, the art collection, and that Kevin Orr, then the city manager, was asking or demanding about $500 million from the art museum. Are those numbers correct?
There was the collection has been variously evaluated.
Right.
It's my guess. It's probably about $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a guess.
Yeah.
Initially, there was suggestions that somehow the DIA could come up with that kind of money by itself,
yeah.
which was never on the cards. And I think the idea behind it was that, well, maybe the museum can't raise it, but perhaps it could sell some art to do so.
How perilously close to the edge did this idea actually get, where you all would have had to consider literally selling art?
We would never have sold the art as the institution. What would have had to happen is that the emergency manager had the power to cancel any contracts that the city had. And the DIA was run by a private organization for the city with a contract. Mm-hmm. So to sell the art, that's not something we were going to do, because it's a deeply unethical thing as far as we are concerned. The city manager would have had to cancel the contract, seize the collection, take it back to the city, and then do it. Clearly, he didn't want to do that because it would effectively close the museum.
So now, as one of the benefits, I suspect you see this as a benefit, of this grand bargain is that DIA no longer is under the thumb, if you will, these are my words, not yours, under the thumb of the city, which is a good thing, I suspect, in the short run. In the long run, when the city turns around, and you no longer have the resources that the city can provide to the museum, would the museum be in trouble again?
Yes, I mean, when the museum became a city department in 1919, it sounded like a wonderful idea. Mm-hmm. The city was full of flush, and, but it, over the decades, it turned out to be not such a good thing. And for the past 15, 16, 17 years, the museum has actually been run by a private organization on behalf of the city. Mm-hmm. And so we got the millage passed, and we're now supported by three counties, and will be for the next few years. And so making the museum independent again does remove that one component, as you say, of being part of a larger political system, which brings its advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah. So, Sarup, I wanted to have you on the program because part of your responsibility at the museum is to make us all have a greater appreciation for the art that is at the museum. How do you do that in a city that people think are divided in a variety of ways? How do you put together exhibits? How do you showcase the art that you have? How do you bring artists to town? How do you go about curating exhibits that appeal to everybody in the city?
I would say that this is a long-standing practice, actually, that we've come to instill in our internal culture, that actually started after Graham came, that we would work to make the entire collection accessible and take a visitor-centered approach to interpreting the collections, as opposed to using the museum to present strictly art historical concepts and ideas, that we would consult with visitors and our public and develop an understanding of where people come from, the deep, rich stories they bring with them as they come to the museum, and the kinds of questions and concerns and challenges that the museum already had presented in traditional practice, and then try to break that up a little bit by presenting stories, the collection in ways that can appeal to a non-expert audience, but people of every kind of background you can imagine.
Let me ask a politically impolitic question, but I think you can handle it. And I'm gonna do it by raising a dirty word. It starts with G, it's called gentrification. I wonder to what extent the gentrification of this city, particularly the downtown region of this city, will impact what the museum offers. And I ask that against the backdrop of these long-standing residents of the city, some of whom might have never felt connected to the museum in the first place. And now that the city demographically is changing, will they feel further alienated by their own museum?
I hope not. I think it's our work and it's our intention to bring real collaborations into the museum, whether it's in presenting an exhibition. We do extensive focus groups that's now built into our practice, where we talk with people who live in the region, in the city, and really gauge them for what we're presenting, what ideas we're asking them to test for us. Mm-hmm. And they might push us in new directions. We want to incorporate their voices into the exhibitions themselves by either through the process of developing the storylines or even directly in the exhibitions, having ways for them to enter their responses or reactions to the art. Mm-hmm. So we are there's always more that we can do. It is an absolute goal and interest to open up the work.
Before Graham came on the program tonight, as we were walking on stage, I wanted to thank him. I thanked him for the wonderful leadership he provided in LA. As you know, I live in Los Angeles. The show emanates typically from LA. In Detroit this week, I wanted to thank you for your work at our museum in LA, where you spent almost a decade.
Not quite.
But you were there for a few years.
Yeah.
And then you came here to Detroit. I'm told now that you're actually, now that you're on the other side of this crisis, going to retire. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. My contract expires at the end of June, and I decided that it was time to hand over to somebody.
Well, I guess if you can survive this retirement, you've earned this retirement.
Yes. Yes.
Please thank Graham Beal and Sarupa Neela for being on the program tonight. Thank you for both being here.
Thank you.
Pleased to be joined now by the president of Wayne State University, Dr. Roy Wilson. Please welcome him. Good to see you.
Thank you.
I know these numbers are disturbing for you because they're disturbing for me, but I'm not the president of an institution here in town. The graduation rate here in Detroit is abysmal. The high school graduation rate is abysmal. And yet in the center of all of that, you are a local university,
right.
National tentacles, but a local university that has to somehow navigate that. How do you do that?
Well, you're right. We are a local university, but as you said, national tentacles, we're actually global in our scope because of our research. And so it is a university with a dual personality, so to speak. Certainly part of our commitment, a very big part of our commitment, is to the citizens of Detroit. In many, many ways, mm-hmm. but certainly to the students of Detroit. And the fact of the matter is, as happens in many urban environments, there are a lot of challenges and barriers to students getting a great education in high school. Some of those can be dealt with by the student themselves. Mm-hmm. Others are challenges that are in the external environment. You know, many come from broken homes. Many don't have the encouragement to go to a school and compete at a high level. Many get sidetracked with athletics and many other temptations. So we do feel like it is our mission to make sure that those students who are highly motivated, who have the skills, and who have the desire to get a higher education, that we have a place for them here at Wayne State.
There are folk in this city, too many, and I know this because everywhere I go in town, I hear stories about this. People who are citizens who are struggling just to pay their water bills, and we don't even want to have a conversation about how the residents feel about water valves being shut off. How in a city where many are struggling to pay their water bill can they get a high quality education when they're being certainly priced out of higher ed?
Well, we try to keep our tuition very affordable, and we're still among the lowest, despite the fact that we have a vast research portfolio, we still are among the lowest of the public universities because we feel, as you just said, that there's many students that just can't afford a college education. You know, it's really amazing to me that sometimes, and I've met so many students like this, where just a few dollars can make a big difference as to whether they persist in school and graduate or not. Dollars that will seem almost insignificant to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just a couple hundred dollars will make the difference between them being able to stay in school and graduate and them having to drop out and go work somewhere.
I mentioned there's a new tech center here, relatively new tech center here on campus. I mentioned throughout the week that one of the things that is booming in Detroit is technology. There are a lot of tech companies that are locating, relocating, expanding into Detroit. So it's got its own sort of Silicon Valley in downtown Detroit.
Right.
What role specifically do you see Wayne State playing in the rebirth, the revitalization of the city writ large?
Wayne State is playing a huge role, whether it's in economic development, real estate development, business development. We're involved with all of that. For example, we're one of the only universities that have a vice president, a cabinet level person, whose title is basically vice president for economic development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this person also just recently took on the role, you mentioned TechTown. He's now the CEO of TechTown also, so he has a dual role. Not very many universities will have that kind of high-level position. In terms of business development, we have the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses here. Mm-hmm. That's, I think Goldman Sachs has put together $500 million, $500 million throughout a number of cities to try to get small businesses up and going, entrepreneurship in terms of instruction, gaining knowledge, but gaining also some financial capital to be able to start their own businesses. That's based here. We have a number of other programs that are very technology-oriented, including, by the way, we just started our capital campaign about 6 months ago, and we were able to announce the capital campaign with a $25 million gift for a venture capital institute.
Oh, beautiful. I mentioned to the audience when we came on the air tonight that one of the joys of being here this week is being back on this campus. When I was a student just down the road at Indiana University, I was on the debate team there. And every year there was a huge national debate tournament that was hosted here at Wayne State. So every year of my college career, I spent at least 4 or 5 days every year on this campus participating in this national debate competition. Yeah. And so it's always an honor to come back on this campus. And thank you for hosting us throughout the week. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Let me just say that I would hate to be against you in debating.
Well, yeah. well, you know what? And let me just say that I have never qualified to run anybody's university, so I'm honored to have you on the program. Please thank President Wilson from Wayne State University. Without good schools, Detroit's comeback may be stalled before it even has a chance to succeed. Lots of smart people have tried to fix what's broken with little success, but the residents here aren't giving up. The latest to try to create a roadmap for positive change is Darnell Early, the fourth emergency manager for Detroit schools in 6 years. Also working on this is the Skillman Foundation, one of our funders for this week, I'm happy to say. They've put together a coalition to come up with solutions to the city's schools. Their first report is due out next week, so tonight a preview. Joining me tonight are Darnell Early, David Hecker, president of the American Federation of Teachers in Michigan. Also with us tonight, Denise Smith, vice president of Early Learning of Excellent Schools, and Tanya Allen, president of the Skillman Foundation. Thank you all for being here. Please welcome the panel.
Thank you.
To Wayne State University. So, Darnell, I have one question for you. Why? the fourth person to try this in 6 years. Yeah. I love the spirit of the city not giving up.
Yeah.
But if these problems are that intractable, what do you expect to be able to do?
Well, the answer to your first question, the why, is we have to, is the why. The lives and livelihoods of some 47,000 students in Detroit public schools are depending on us to solve these issues. There have been other emergency managers, as you've stated, and I liken each of those appointments to one step further to getting a handle on some of the many problems that plague our students. And we just can't give up because we can't afford to fail in that effort to be able to make a very competitive educational experience for our children.
What has been the perennial problem or problems? What is making this nut so hard to crack?
Well, it's a lot of problems. I think the misconception is that there's one thing that can be pointed to and diagnosed as the cause. But we're talking about decades of issues that have plagued not only Detroit public schools, but urban school districts in general. And I think it's important for us to realize that the only way we're going to do this is through a collaborative effort of a lot of stakeholders and a lot of people who want to invest and want to see these problems solved. So I can't point to any one thing, Tavis. I think what I can say is that the more we talk about these issues and the more people talk about them, we're starting to say the same things over again. So we've identified the main causes, and now it's incumbent upon us to come up with some solutions to address those causes.
So, Tanya, speaking of working collaboratively, you are the co-chair of a committee of 31 people, I think, stakeholders who've all come together to try to figure this out. As I mentioned earlier, your report is due out next week. Maybe I should have come to Detroit next week instead of this week. But since you're here, give me a preview of what we're gonna discover next week about whatever y'all are gonna suggest to fix this problem.
Well, first I would say we're glad to have you here
to be here. Thank you.
But what I would say is what we're finding is that there are several culprits in the challenges that we're seeing. The first is finance. So as much as we want to talk about what educators are doing or not doing, the biggest issue that we're facing is that our school district has shrunk. It's one quarter of the size that it used to be 20 years ago. And as a result of that, we've had to shrink with all of these fixed costs for a very long time, and that's a key issue. And I think the second thing is that we have equated regulation with accountability. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of that, we're busying our educators with filling out forms and not focusing on the core business, which is education. And then the last thing is, I think we have to lift up our expectations around educational and academic excellence. And what we're finding is that that isn't just a Detroit problem, it's actually a state of Michigan problem. Mm-hmm. So we have been sliding backwards as a state for many years, and it's time for us to not only address the issues in Detroit, but take it and make it broader and look at what's going on in our state.
Maybe I missed something here, but if I heard you say, as the viewers may have heard as well, that the size of the school district is shrinking, I take that to mean that there are fewer students in Detroit now than there were some years ago. If there are fewer students, then why doesn't it become easier to educate those? That sounds like smaller classrooms, not by design, but smaller classrooms, which is one of the things we're told makes educating kids easier.
Well, it's fewer students spread across multiple school districts. So in Detroit, I think unlike many other places, we have over 60 school districts in the city of Detroit. And then our children, 120,000 children, go to about 11 school districts outside of the city of Detroit. So there's no stability or predictability around finances.
Why so many districts?
Because we have our state legislature opened up the charter cap. So we have all of these charters in the city of Detroit that are operated by 14 different authorizers. So that means that nobody is paying attention to each other. They're putting new schools next to good schools. There are some places in the city where there aren't strong enough schools and nobody's coming to those particular areas. That lack of coordination, the lack of focus, and the lack of having any singular entity looking at all of our children and ensuring that they're doing well is a big problem in Detroit.
We're not going to debate charter schools tonight, Denise. I could do this for hours.
Okay.
I got my own point of view. We're not going to debate that tonight.
Okay.
But it's clear to me, though, that if parents are going the charter route, they're doing that because they feel that public education in Detroit otherwise is failing their kids. I know why they're going there. They're trying to get the best choices for their kids. But what are they finding when they get there? Apparently, it's not just these schools. Public schools aren't working. These charter schools aren't working.
I would have to say that all of the schools in the city are actually failing our children. Mm-hmm. In 2009, we were on the map once again, Detroit, not for the notorious crimes notorious things of crime and, robbery, et cetera, but really for failing our children. And that hasn't changed. As Tanya indicated before, the trends are continuing to be there. So even though with this onslaught of charter schools and our public school systems have continued to fail our children, and it's been generational, as mentioned before. So we have actually those adults who are now having children, and in some cases teaching our children, who have been a product of that failing system. And so now we don't have the kind of teachers that are in place, regardless of whether they need to go. So our talent pool is lacking, regardless of whether they're in a charter school or in a public school, who are actually equipped to be able to do the job that we're asking them to do.
This question, David, may be somewhat politically incorrect, not the first or last one that I will ask that fits in that category, I promise you. But I wonder whether or not there is in this city, for all the generations y'all have been trying to solve this problem here, and certainly on this side of bankruptcy, whether or not there is DPS fatigue, whether or not there's a fatigue in the city. We talked earlier about the fact that I celebrate the fact that people haven't given up. I mean, Tanya and Darnell and all the work that you all are doing suggests that people haven't given up on public education. But I wonder whether or not for some stakeholders, for some residents of the city, certainly for those who've left the city, whether or not people are just fatigued by trying to fix Detroit public schools.
Well, one thing I want to add before getting to that, to the points that Tanya and Darnell made about the issues facing DPS and charter schools and all schools in the city of Detroit, is the unfortunate high level of poverty. And children out of poverty bring certain things to the table, obstacles that my children have been fortunate enough not to have to face. And there's no getting around the impact on poverty. One thing that's been very invigorating, many things in working with the coalition, is that there's a strong commitment to DPS. There's a strong understanding that this city needs a strong, what we call traditional school district that accepts every child that comes through the door. And this city, the people of the city over the years have been incredibly, incredibly generous in bond votes, in millage votes, and obviously we're not talking about a high-income community. Tremendous support for DPS, and on this coalition, there's a strong understanding that this city needs a strong DPS, as well as strong charter schools, a great school for every child.
That's my question, though. My question is, why should the residents of this city, particularly on this side of bankruptcy, I've been reading and watching the TV ads in the few days I've been here about this Prop 1. People don't want to even pay a penny more because they don't believe that the money is really going to go to fix the roads. And again, if you've been bamboozled as many times as Detroiters have, I kind of understand that sentiment, although I think I would vote for it where I hear it. That's another conversation, but I understand why people feel that way. You're making my point. The people of this city have been very generous with education in this city for generations, and yet the problems have not been fixed.
Right.
Tell me why I shouldn't believe that people are just tired of this rhetoric now. They're fatigued by the school
system. Well, I have no doubt that there are a number of people tired and say, you know, like people have said, this isn't the first committee to take a look at enhancing education in the city of Detroit. I do think, though, it's a unique time in the city for advancing this work. One, I know you had Judge Rhodes on the show talking about the grand bargain, and people may disagree with certain parts of the grand bargain. We're out of bankruptcy. We have empowered a mayor, empowered city council. It's an exciting time. There is so much going on in the city. Businesses coming in, restaurants opening up, housing being erected. It needs to get beyond downtown and midtown, but good things are happening. And I think there's more of an optimism because of those things in the city moving forward. So I think people are committed to seeing seeing DPS.
And yet, Tanya, I read just this morning, I guess, or yesterday, last night, that one of your committee members has already resigned from the committee before the report even comes out next week because she feels, a school board member in Ann Arbor, I believe it is, I read, resigned from the committee because she feels that what you all are about to tell us next week is, number one, going to be a rubber stamp for what the governor, the Republican governor, Mr. Snyder of this state, wants to do on education. So she's already resigned in advance of the report coming out, number one. And number two, her concerns are that what's going to be released to the public next week when I'm out of here is more conceptual than actual, than practical. Your thoughts on both of those points?
Well, I would say we brought together a group of really diverse and eclectic people who had different ideological viewpoints on this, and we decided we were going to wrestle with it. The person that you're mentioning, she actually served on a subcommittee of the coalition, and I would say that she was one of a couple hundred people who resigned. So the news is that one person resigned, but 199 stayed together, and they fought it through. And I think what we're proving through this coalition is that Detroiters are doing things differently.
I take your point. My purpose in raising her was not to elevate her above the 199 that stayed. My point is to ask whether or not people, the citizens of this city, can expect something that is concrete as opposed to conceptual next week, number one. And number two, whether or not what they're going to hear when all is said and done, that this is, as someone said, a rubber stamp, what the governor wants anyway.
Absolutely, and I would tell you this, we're not rubber stamping anything anybody wants.
Right.
I would say that we are gonna bring forth a set of recommendations that are gonna be clear and actionable, that we believe needs to happen around financing, that needs to happen around governance, that needs to happen around academics, and also what needs to happen as a community. Many of us in Detroit have not had a say in education in many years. So now that we want to say in it, then we have to be accountable and responsible, and we have to have a level of agency that this is our time, these are our children, and we'll fix it for them.
One final question I want to give Darnell and Denise a chance to get back in here right quick. You first, Darnell. Why should I not believe that the children really are going to be left behind? David made the point earlier, and I've been making the point all week, that the comeback of downtown can't render downtown as an island. It's got to be more, this success in downtown, it's got to be a bridge to the rest of the city. But it's hard to believe that as everybody else progresses, that the kids ain't going to be left behind, pardon my English.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that there will be no comeback or recovery for Detroit unless we bring the children along, the students along, in a competitively planned educational experience. I mean, we have to do all that we can despite the frustrations, despite the fatigue, if you will, because we simply cannot afford to not be able to provide a competitive education. And those of us who work in the public sector, we understand that charge, and so we do all that we can, and we try to enlist the support and the engagement of others, like the group that Tanya was speaking of. Listen, there are no quick answers or no easy answers to this, but I'd rather spend time trying to find an answer than saying there are no answers, and yep. so we have to forget about those individuals coming up. I will not do that as long as I'm able to reach back and help someone else come up forward.
Denise, as you know, finally, the children in Detroit Public Schools and in these charter schools, for that matter, these kids cannot vote. And as we know in our society writ large, because kids can't vote so often, they are, in fact, left behind, although we put these cute slogans out and leave no child behind. Can you disabuse me of the notion that the children aren't going to be forgotten?
Certainly, I will do that. And speaking for myself as a native Detroiter, these children are my children. And I think there are many who are in this fight with that same sentiment. And they believe that these children deserve an opportunity to have the very best opportunities. I believe that every child, regardless of zip code, their station in life, or even their race, deserves that quality start. It's going to be critical to their success later in school and in life. And I think what we've missed, probably the largest oversight was early, is really is my focus and body of work, is that we haven't begun to create and invest in high quality early in quality in education to ensure that the remediation that we're seeing later in high school, et cetera, doesn't have to happen.
Early education is the key. I think anybody who doesn't understand that misses the whole point of what's wrong with our system. But I digress. Please thank Darnell and David and Denise and Tanya for being here tonight. I appreciate you all for coming. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.